Hey, you guys. Time once again for Flickers of Fear, my little movie review series. Got a little bit of an obscure one for you today. Now, I have to tell you, I honestly have no idea why this particular 1989 film, Cameron's Closet, or at least like the title of it and sort of like the cover image, kind of stuck with me, like after all these years. Pretty sure that I saw this movie like on cable, probably back in the early 1990s, because I think it's definitely one of those movies that had really inexpensive broadcast rights and it would have played like a bunch of times a day, like on one of the pay channels, like back when they didn't have enough content, you know what I mean? I can't say that I remembered anything in particular about this movie, like including whether I liked it or not, but for whatever reason, like when I was recently kind of scrolling through Tubi, like looking for something to review, and I saw it, I kind of felt a little like, ooh, like a little remembrance, a little nostalgia thing. And so I was like, yeah, I should probably like rewatch that. Maybe I liked it, and that's why it just like stuck out to me. And then when I did rewatch it, I have to say I was even more mystified than I was before, like why this particular movie like lodged in my brain the way it did. I don't know why my brain works the way it does. Please don't ask me. I've tried for 50 years to try to figure it out and I still don't know. The same thing, incidentally, like happened to me with that 1977 movie, Kathy's Curse, which I think I reviewed like on this series, like probably like last year sometime. It was another one that I just like remembered. I was like, ooh, I remember the cover and I remember the title. And then I watched it. And I'm like, why the fuck did I remember that? I don't really know. I mean, not that Cameron's Closet is a bad movie, really. It's really not. It's not great, but it's not bad. I mean, it's cheesy and it, you know, certainly has its weaknesses, but it's really no worse, but it's also no more distinctive than, you know, any number of other late 1980s, low budget, targeted toward the home video market kind of movies. It had some decent gore in it and some, you know, entertaining and like over the top kills, had some pretty solid acting from some of the people, and, you know, kind of an interesting story. Had some like big horror stalwarts, you know, like working behind the scenes. So, you know, it wasn't as good as like the 1987 movie The Gate, for example, which it does kind of like remind me of a little bit. It's not that similar, but it kind of gave me that kind of vibe, even though The Gate I feel like was more targeted toward teenagers or tweens, whereas this one is, you would think that, but it's actually not really for kids because it's like pretty gory. I mean, this is just kind of like a fun, mostly forgotten kind of slice of 80s Gorgonzola, if you want to call it that, that really barely anybody ever talks about anymore. But, you know, because when I was scrolling through Tubi and it just snagged my eyeballs and I was like, why do I remember this movie? You know, I'm gonna buck the trend and I'm gonna discuss it. So you're welcome. Now, when I mentioned that there was like kind of a lot of well-known horror people behind the scenes on this thing, I actually was not kidding. So the screenplay for Cameron's Closet was written by Gary Brandner, who probably best known for writing the novel that the movie The Howling was based on. Like, it's actually like a trilogy, but only the first Joe Dante directed movie was based on the novel. Like the other two novels, Howling novels that Gary Brandner wrote, you know, they didn't correspond to like the sequel. So don't blame him for those. You know what I mean? So yeah, so you got the guy that wrote the book, The Howling. The special effects were actually done by Carlo Rambaldi, who won a couple of Oscars. He was the guy that designed E.T., you know, the extraterrestrial. Also worked on special effects for the 1976 version of King Kong, Alien, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Dune, the David Lynch one, and Dario Argento's Deep Red, so you got that. The director, Armand Mastroianni, he kind of burst onto the landscape in 1980 with He Knows You're Alone. And he also did some other movies too, but he did like a lot of really cool like horror and sci-fi TV series, you know, directed like a lot of episodes of those, like in the, like from like the 80s to the early 2000s. Like he worked on Tales from the Dark Side, Friday the 13th, the series, the 90s reboot of Dark Shadows, The Dead Zone, the series that was, you know, based on the Stephen King novel, which is actually really good and underrated. Anthony Michael Hall is in it. So I recommend that if you haven't seen it. We actually have it on DVD here at the house and it's really, really good. And it's kind of sad that a lot of people don't talk about it. Oh, and if all that wasn't enough, William Lustig, much beloved by horror nerds for directing both 1980s Maniac and 1988's Maniac Cop, actually like appears in a cameo in one scene. Like he plays a pornographer that gets busted by the cops like in a police station. So even though Cameron's Closet, I guess, you wouldn't really consider it a prestige project or anything like that, but there was a hell of a lot of talent that went into the making of it. So the movie starts out like kind of along the same lines as something maybe like Firestarter or maybe Carrie, like to a lesser degree. There's a 10-year-old boy named Cameron Lansing, who's played by Scott Curtis, who I think went on to become a musician later on. And he has like a very pronounced like psychokinetic powers, right? His single dad, Owen, is actually played by the 50s and 60s heartthrob Tab Hunter, who he's been in like a million movies. Yeah, look at his IMDb page. I actually remember him as the... I know this is gonna sound funny, but I actually remember him from Grease 2 for being the teacher where they do the reproduction song. I don't know why I remember him from that, because he's been in a fuck ton of other stuff, but I remember him from that. So the dad, Owen, is a scientist, and he's basically studying the kid's abilities, and the dad has an assistant named Professor Ben Majors. Not too far into the story, though. It's pretty clear that whatever it is the two men were hoping to achieve, they were trying to like unlock hidden powers of the mind or something like through this kid. Well, it's gone drastically awry, let's call it that. And it's implied that perhaps demons, or specifically one demon, has become involved in the situation. Owen has apparently decided that the only way to solve this problem is to kill his own son. But as he goes to do just that, some force intervenes, causing Owen to accidentally fall onto his own machete and behead himself, which I admit that I wasn't expecting a scene like that, like that early in the film. Like, it was like 5 minutes in, and I'm like, oh, okay, we're doing this. We're doing self-beheading. All right, I'm on board. So Cameron then gets sent to live with his mom, whose name is Dory, and her abusive meathead of a boyfriend, whose name is Bob. And honestly, Bob is like the most hateable, easily the most hateable character. He's supposed to be hateable. Like, you just cannot wait to see him like eat some telekinetic shit, because he's like one of the world's champion douchebags. If they gave out medals for that shit, he would be right there, like getting the gold. So I forgot to mention, though, that while all of this kind of like family drama is going on like over here, over there, there's this whole other subplot happening, like, and this involves a cop named Sergeant Sam Taliaferro, and he keeps getting his ass reamed by his superiors for, like, spacing out and falling asleep on the job. So, during one of these, you know, sessions where his, you know, God damn it, what, you're a good cop, what's the matter with you, you know, one of those kind of meetings, he complains that he hasn't really been getting much sleep because he's been having all these recurring nightmares. So his boss sends him to see, like, this police psychiatrist, who, much to Sam's shock and chagrin, is a woman in a scene that's, like, this was 1989, this movie came out. It was like, yeah, they have female psychiatrists. We've had that for decades and decades now. Like, please get on board. Get with the program. But I just thought that was kind of funny. I don't know if it was just because she was a woman or just because she was, like, a good-looking woman. Maybe that's what it was. I'm not really sure. So it's Dr. Nora Haley is the doctor, and she's actually played by Mel Harris, who I think is probably best known for being on 30-something. And she, like, wants to help him, but Sam is very, very, very hostile, insisting, it's like, hey, I'm not a nut like all the other people that come in here. I'm like, someone's a little defensive. Yeah, he comes across like that. I mean, he's like, where I come from, which I don't know where that is, people take care of their own problems, even though he insists he doesn't have any problems. So I'm like, all right, you're one of those. I see. So for a while in the movie, like, while I'm watching it, like, it's not clear exactly like how Cameron's story and Sam's story are related, but finally, like, if you kind of, you know, are patient a little bit, the two threads of the story kind of like intertwine. So Cameron, you see, has started talking to someone or something in his closet, which should be evident from the name of the movie, and he calls it Deceptor, which is also the name of this weird, like, Pazuzu-esque kind of statue that he actually got from his dad, but he's been playing with as a toy. Like, him and he has, like, that little muscle man. It's not Stretch Armstrong, but it kind of looks like that, except it's not, like, poseable or anything. And he, like, had them fight, you know, like a little boy would do. So one evening after Cameron's, you know, just talking to the person in his closet, and just his general existence, you know, really, has aggravated the boyfriend, Bob, you know, kind of past the point of reason, this big chuckle fuck, like, goes into Cameron's room and starts kind of, like, hefting the kid around and, like, being abusive and whatnot. And this seemingly causes a demon to pop out the closet, burn out Bob's eyeballs, which is nice, and fling him out a second story window. Exorcist style. I'm gonna say Bob really catches some air too. I mean, like, so much so that, like, when the cops arrive, because he lands on top of a car, so like when the cops get there, they wonder whether the dude fell out of an airplane, which I don't know why that made me laugh so hard, but it did. So anyway, it's at this point, probably like half an hour, 40 minutes of the movie, something like that, where Sam and Cameron meet, as Sam is investigating like Bob's weird ass death. Now, Dr. Haley is also on the scene because she's kind of trying to assess the trauma that Cameron might be experiencing after, you know, essentially witnessing his mom's boyfriend get yeeted halfway across the neighborhood, which is like, I don't know why I thought that was so, I mean, he went flying. It was like hysterical. And it's actually like not a bad effect too. So while she's talking to the kid though, she notices that Cameron appears to use telekinesis, like, to keep a vase from falling off the mantle. Like, a cop walks by, and the vase is like, whoa, and it's like off, and then it stops, like, in midair, and it goes back, and she sees the kid, like, looking over there at it, and she's like, that kid has psychic powers. I mean, she's right, but it's like, I was like, she's a psychiatrist, so you would think that immediately, she wouldn't jump immediately to that, but, you know, whatever, it's the 80s, and they're just like, oh, okay. Cool, you have telekinetic powers. All right, so let's drill down on that. So as the story goes on, like, Cameron starts to develop kind of a rapport, like a relationship with Sam, as he's now like completely without a father figure, because, you know, he's 0 for 2 at this point or whatever, because it's like they're both dead. I mean, but the two candidates that he had before were not really any great shakes, poor kid. So you know what I mean? He needs a dad, and this guy's like there. It's actually implied that Cameron was the one that was sending Sam, like, all those dreams, I guess unconsciously, like, in some way, like, asking for help. Sam also starts to become a little bit, you know, squishy, a little bit enamored toward Dr. Haley. Unfortunately, though, things aren't all rainbows and unicorn farts and whatnot, as the demon, which has attached itself to Cameron, I guess, it's eventually identified as, like, a Mayan entity called Zialtho, the essence of evil. He's kind of still fucking shit up, killing pretty much everybody around the kid in, you know, creative ways, and even threatening to chuck Cameron himself into the blades of a supernaturally speedy ceiling fan, so there's that. There's another whole thing about the demon disguising itself as, like, the zombified versions of people it's already killed in order to, like, fool people into doing things, like, in order to fool Sam into, like, killing the kid and shit like that. I guess that's why the kid started out calling him Deceptor, kind of like a Transformers kind of reference, or, you know what I mean, whatever it is. The thing about it, though, is that I kind of feel like the mythology of the demon was a little bit muddled, because I was like, well, wait, it's like, I thought they said... I mean, and admittedly, maybe I wasn't, like, paying super close attention, but I thought they said that it's like, oh, well, the demon can't kill the kid because the demon is, like, the kid is, like, the demon's conduit, like, into this dimension or whatever. But then, like, the demon does try to kill the kid, and then it tries to, like, fool Sam and, like, other people into killing the kid, too, because it was trying to get the dad to kill the kid at the beginning, like, with the machete, but then it saved it. I don't really know. It's, like, it's very confusing. And I'm not really sure, like, what the demon's endgame was exactly, but whatever. Happily, it all works out in the end. Cameron uses his awesome powers and optical effects and things like that to send Zialtho back to the hell from whence he emerged. Which, it should be noted, Cameron was the one that kind of, like, summoned him from in the first place, although, I mean, in the kid's defense, he didn't really do it on purpose, so, you know. So, I mean, Cameron's Closet, I mean, it's not gonna win any awards or anything like that, but it was, like, a pretty brisk, entertaining little flick. I mean, it's only, like, 87 minutes long or something like that. I don't know if I'd recommend it to anybody that didn't see it back in the day, because I feel like you probably like this one better if you had some of that kind of, like, nostalgia factor happening. Like, I don't think it's a good movie, like, on its own. Some of the effects are actually quite good. I mean, considering, like, the team that worked on this, who had worked on, like, some really great movies. I mean, Tab Hunter getting beheaded, like, in the beginning, that looked pretty good. Bob's eyes getting scorched out, that looked pretty good. And then there was one scene where Professor Ben Majors, one of the assistant guy, he kind of gets almost like open air microwaved, like a dollar store Hot Pocket. Like, you know what I mean? So that looked pretty good. On the other hand, though, the creature design on the demon was, let's call it, less than ideal. It wasn't great. I'm going to give the effects team the benefit of the doubt on that one, though, and assume that maybe they ran out of time and or money, because it really looks kind of, like, cheesy, and I think they kind of, like, show it a little too much so you can see, like, how cheap it looks, which is kind of unfortunate. Now, this movie actually did get a very limited theatrical release, believe it or not, But it came out on VHS like the same year that it had played in theaters. So I'm guessing that was, you know, the target market all along. And I guess it must have some kind of at least like small cult following because it did get like a DVD release in 2004. But to be honest, it's like really not a movie that gets mentioned all that much. And as far as I know, like nobody's clamoring for like a special edition Blu-ray steelbook or anything like that. But I mean, if you like movies about demons and telekinetic kids and you're kind of in the mood for like some late 80s nostalgia, because this is a very, very 80s movie, then you might dig it. Like I said, it's free. It's on Tubi. You know, it's, I know that some people do have some affection for it because they saw it back in the day. I saw it back in the day too, but I didn't remember anything about it. So I don't know if I had that nostalgia factor going in. But it's fine. I've seen like way, way worse movies than this. But you know, I've seen way better ones too. So that's the thing. So it's up to you, like if you want to watch it or if it sounds interesting or if it sounds cool, then check it out. It's free. And tell me what you thought about it in the comments or even if you had ever even heard of it, because I feel like a lot of people haven't. So that'll do it for this Flickers of Fear. I'll see you guys again on the next one. Bye.